Well, hi everyone, and welcome to Designers for Learning. Today is April 24th, and I'm very happy to have with me today my guest, Rick West. Do you like to go by Richard or Rick?
You know, that is a really good question. So I went by Richard, and I'll just tell you this funny story real briefly. But
please
when
do.
My when my parents had me, they liked the name Richard, but my mom said, "Yeah, but you know, we can't call him Richard because someone will call him Rick, and I hate the name Rick. But we can't do this." And my dad was like, "No, no, no. We'll tell everybody that his name is Richard, and they have to call him Richard." And that worked until I got autonomous in high school and told people to go by that I went by Rick then. And so I've mellowed since then, and I go by both. But if you're a family member, it's still Richard. If, you know, most other folks call me Rick.
Is that so funny? No, yeah. In my family, it's just the opposite. When I was growing up, I was Jenny, and no, trust me, no one now calls me Jenny except my family. If I hear Jenny, it's like, where? I look around.
Yeah.
I go by Jennifer or Jen, but I don't know where this Jenny, we kind of abandoned that years ago, but that's cute. So I just wanted to give you a chance to introduce yourself. You're an assistant professor at Brigham Young University, and you want to just give us a little bit of a background on where you did your graduate work and how you made your way to BYU, and just kind of give us a little overview of what your research and teaching interests are in
sure.
at BYU.
So my background is kind of an interesting background. Probably as many people that listen to this podcast, instructional designers and so forth, a lot of those folks, we kind of come to this field sometimes in different ways. So I was actually a professional journalist working at daily newspapers. I was a sports writer.
Wow.
And was doing that, yeah, I was a sports writer, and English was my bachelor's degree. But I wanted a career shift. I wanted to be able to do something a little different. I wanted to be able to work in a university setting. And so I learned about the field of instructional design, and went to BYU for my master's degree in this department, instructional psychology and technology. And then I went to Georgia, the University of Georgia, for my PhD, and I worked with Dr. Hannafin there. And while I was there, I was always interested in social learning. And that was kind of a lot of my background, was communities of practice, cognitive apprenticeship, you know, social learning theories. And I got into that and started to think about how social learning, I started to think about the way people work nowadays versus the way people worked, you know, before. And realizing with the internet and with kind of the information age and the explosion of networked technologies that we have, that people work very differently in many kinds of professions, and that we're kind of entering this innovation age that a lot of people have talked about. And so I started to think, well, what does social learning have to teach us about the way people work today? And that's where I started getting interested in social innovation, and not social innovation in terms of, you know, let's do good work in third world countries, which I think is good as well, but talking about the actual social creative act. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I got interested in and did my dissertation on that. And that's largely a lot of the research I do still is on social creativity.
So how would you then help put this into the context of when we think of a lot of folks that we participate and interact with on EdTech Talk are K-12 educators. And so when we talk about instruction, we're mainly talking about a fairly formal instructional setting where it's a course. So when you're talking about your communities of, I keep saying communities of inquiry. That was my dissertation. Was when I was your COI, I always think
of
inquiry.
I know. He coined the acronym already.
Exactly. And so how would you compare and contrast it? Would you say yours is not necessarily context specific, so it could be in a workplace setting, it could be in a course, or what? Just kind of help us frame what you're talking about.
That is exactly true. And so one of the things that I worry about a lot is I think we have a misperception about what creativity is. You ask most people what it means to be creative, and they say, well, people that draw, people that you know, play music. Mm-hmm. But that's interesting because I play piano, but I do not play piano in a creative way. I am not a very creative pianist. I very much have to follow exactly what's written, or it just doesn't happen. I can't do anything creatively with the instrument. And so I think sometimes we equate the arts with creativity. And while definitely there is a high level of creativity that's manifested in the arts, I don't believe that is the only place where creativity emerges, and that really creativity happens in any domain. Mm-hmm. And that while there may be, maybe say, different flavors of creativity that are discipline specific, I think there are some principles that are very much kind of discipline agnostic and just kind of go across disciplines. And that's kind of what I'm interested in, are these general ideas about how do we get people together to work on ideas And, and so my research, a lot of, we'll be getting into this, I suppose, but I've researched everything from engineers to animators to instructional designers, and find that there are some very, similar kinds of things happening in the way groups do their creative work in all these different disciplines.
Okay. And so I guess a lot of this then, in terms of framing things, depends on what type of outcome you're looking at. Because a lot of time when we think about a typical course, the outcomes would be the learning objectives that you have. That there's something, so there's something that you want the student to walk away with, skills and knowledge that they weren't aware of when they walked into the class. And so you're talking more generally, though. Now, do you view these communities as kind of a vehicle to forward your learning object, to frame the instructional piece of it to help facilitate learning? Or is, how do you kind of, I guess, mesh the two between like a learning objective versus facilitating a creative process?
That is a really interesting question, and that taps onto a lot of things that I could talk about. But so when I talk about these communities of innovation, I am talking more about the environments that are created that facilitate, because you can't, the hard thing about creativity, and this is why it's not often listed as a learning outcome, is because it's hard to measure. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to make sure that someone does it. You can make sure that someone memorizes something, and you can make sure that by doing something often enough that someone will get a piece of information and will be able to, conceptualize it in the way that you want them to conceptualize it. It's really hard to make someone be creative. Mm-hmm. But what you can do is create environments that make it more likely to emerge and make it more probable. That's what I'm talking about, is the environment. Now, going back to the learning outcomes, how does this mesh with learning outcomes? I think in a couple different ways. One, I believe very much that actually you get deeper learning through creative activity. There's learning theories such as constructionism that you're probably familiar with, mm-hmm. which he was talking about in that theory, that you actually learn content by building something. Mm-hmm. And I take that idea as well, although maybe you don't have to be building something physical, like is kind of what's going on in constructionism, but the idea that by being creative, you are learning content in very powerful ways, I think maybe in more powerful ways. Mm-hmm. And so I think in one way it meshes with learning outcomes that way. In another way, I think sometimes we neglect to think of creativity as an outcome in and of itself. And, there's been interesting, so one of the main tests for creative thinking is the Torrance test. We could go off on that if you wanted to, too, but I'm actually trained to give the Torrance test. And the Torrance test is probably the top test for measuring creative thinking. And it's used to identify gifted students and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they've been measuring Torrance scores for decades. And, you're probably familiar with the Flynn effect in IQ scores, where they say every generation IQ scores have gotten higher. And they talk about why that might be, maybe because there's more cognitive stimulation, there's more things going on, we interact in ways that improve people's IQ and so forth and so on. But so IQ has been going up, and so Dr. Kim, and I can't remember where she's at, but she wanted to look and see, well, is there a Flynn effect in creative thinking as well? And she actually found the opposite to be true. Well, we were actually going up in creative thinking until 1990, and in the last 20 years, our creative thinking scores have gone down. So I'm actually really concerned that in our age of standardized testing, which I'm not necessarily against, but I think in this age of standardized testing, we tend to overemphasize the types of learning that can be measured easily, and we're forgetting about things like creative thinking, which may be the most important outcome of all, and sometimes isn't talked about.
So you're describing creativity as you said, an outcome in and of itself, and then also through a creative process, it helps people learn the material, right? It's also facilitating learning, so it's kind of a dual. It's the outcome in the process at the same time. Okay, excellent. And I'm looking in the chat room. We've got actually Beth was one of my guests on the early on an early show, and we've been talking a lot in this series of webcasts on this idea of applied learning, experiential learning, and asking. Last week we had Trey Martindale on, who has a consultancy where he's getting they're getting their students involved in these real life, real world activities, and it seems like everyone's kind of coming at it from a little bit different angle. But the idea being, and maybe this is a good transition into the paper that I stumbled on of yours is the reason I invited you to come on, is to talk about the studio experience. And I believe that was at University of Georgia?
Yeah, it was.
So can you kind of help me tie together some of these loose ends in terms of the studio experience that that the instructional design students were participating in your research paper? Was the purpose of that tied to what you're talking about in terms of examining the communities of innovation, or was that kind of where you were framing your research around what you were observing?
So a little bit of both. So I was getting interested in this idea of how do we take social learning theory and what we know. Well, let me back up. So I got interested in this idea of creativity being really important in our society, because you look at the way computers have changed things. Information just isn't important anymore. I mean, it's just not. I can go on the internet and find information in 2 seconds. So that just doesn't matter. It used to be that, you wanted people that had vast stores of information so that they could share it with people in the organization or something like that. It just doesn't matter that much anymore. What matters is creativity, because you can't find creativity on the internet. You can find information, but creativity comes from, from within. And then I started to think also about the way people interact. It used to be that the ability to interact as humans was more limited, because we were very much limited by our time and space constraints. But, here we are interacting Jen through the internet. And so the ability for people to work together is so much greater now than it used to be. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the internet kind of converged these things where, innovation became much more valued in society, plus our ability to interact became much more possible, plus the kinds of problems that we're dealing with require a lot more creative problem solving than what we had in the past. So all of this kind of leads to this idea that social innovation is really, really important. And the ability to be socially creative with other people in interactions is important. So I started to get interested in that and wanted to do a dissertation on that. So I looked around, and we had this thing at the University of Georgia called the Instructional Technology Studio, which was designed, I think, brilliantly to facilitate this kind of social creativity to emerge. And I had a couple different papers that I talk about that a little bit, but to kind of maybe give you a scenario here. So this studio is really interesting. There's three different classes, but they are all part of one studio experience. So you have brand new students that don't really know how to do anything in instructional design with really advanced people that are just getting ready to graduate. And they all come together and they meet together for the first hour or so together as a whole group. And then they split up and do their individual things, where the very new people are learning very rudimentary skills and the more advanced people are working on high-level projects for really high clients and all that kind of a thing. But there was also this forced interaction, but also unforced as well. The instructors required the advanced students to mentor the new students for a certain number of hours, during the semester. And the new students were required to serve as consultants and kind of, code monkeys of sorts, or, people helping out on the projects for the advanced students. So advanced students were helping new students were helping advanced students, and this created this kind of scenario where everyone was really had their hands in everybody else's project and everybody else's business. And so you would come and they would say, today we're going to have such and such team present their work, and they would stand up to present their work, and everyone was kind of familiar with what they were doing and could then offer feedback and criticism that supported and helped them, and it was just this marvelous thing. And you would talk to the students about it, and they would say, some of them lived in Atlanta, and they would, which is an hour away, and they would say, you know what, it's kind of a long time to drive to the studio, but I have to come every week because I get creative when I'm here together with these people. This is my creative space. And they recognized that they were getting benefits from just rubbing shoulders with people every week working on these projects together. It was really an interesting setting.
And so, this is, again, trying to tie my loose ends together with all the other guests that I've had on. As I mentioned, I spoke with Beth. And a lot of the objectives that you're talking about, and when I say objectives, I'm not necessarily saying learning objectives, but the whole idea that you're working on something real, you're working on something with a group of people that are doing the same thing, and so there's just kind of a motivational aspect to that. And there's the idea that for the most part, though, I have to say, to kind of contradict what I was saying, that there are common threads. I think this is one of the first times that I've heard anyone describe where this is an applicable thing for a novice. For the most part, these studio experiences tend to be after a kind of like a capstone experience when the students already got what most people would consider to be the basic concepts, and now they're taking it to the next level and applying it. But that's, from what you're saying, that was not the case here. It was kind of throwing everybody in at the get-go.
Right. You know, and I think there is some real value there. I think sometimes we get kind of snooty, and I don't mean this in any bad way, but we get to think, well, I'm the expert, so like shut up and listen to me because I know what I'm talking about.
Right.
And when you study group creativity, you realize that you really have to recognize the value that everybody is bringing to that group. And sometimes the novices they may not have the expertise, but sometimes they have the best ideas because they do have a fresh perspective. And that's really powerful. There's a mathematician, and I don't remember his name right now, but he's one of the most brilliant mathematicians of all time. And one of the reasons is because instead of just taking one line of research and doing one line of study for 35 years, about every 5 years, he reinvents himself because he wants to be an outsider looking in again.
Uh-huh.
And that's really powerful. Sometimes I think, and this was one thing I had with the communities of practice model that I kind of struggled with. The communities of practice model says you start as a novice and you work your way into becoming an expert, and then you kind of stay there as the expert, regenerating other people, but kind of remaining. And that happened a lot in professions back then when that model was developed. But I don't think that happens as much anymore. People are recreating their whole career every 5 years. And I think, well, that's definitely challenging, and that has its own challenges, and expertise is good. Sometimes that fresh perspective of, hey, I'm the new kid on this team, I have other skills I can contribute, plus a fresh perspective, sometimes that's really valuable for group creativity.
So give us, if you can, think of one, a scenario where you would have a mix of the novices and the experts. And when I say experts, I guess I mean more the people that had been in the program a little bit longer and had maybe some more of the foundational knowledge from within the program versus someone, as you're saying, a career changer or someone coming in outside of the discipline. Can you give an example of what we would consider, and again, I don't mean to make a negative out of it, but the novices would contribute beyond what necessarily a person who had more experience would be able to do.
So let me give you maybe a couple of different settings, but one, of course, is IDEO, and everyone wants to use IDEO as their case study, and I guess for good reason, because they really are an innovative group. So they're, of course, probably the top industrial design company in the country. Developed everything from toothbrushes to software to all sorts of things. But when you talk to IDEO, they don't think of themselves as product development. They more think of themselves as process development, that they go into companies, and yeah, they do develop products, but they go into companies and teach them better processes for being creative themselves. And if you look at what IDEO does, they're really interesting because they are typically the industrial designers, but they purposefully will bring in medical students, psychologists, sociologists, and those people will come and join their team to give those kinds of outside perspectives to the project. And so IDEO really values that, someone will come in as a psychologist or med student and say, this is the way we look at things in medical school, and this could be, valuable for this project that we're working on. In an academic setting, I can give you an example. So some of the research I've been doing here at BYU, after I came here as a faculty member after graduating from the University of Georgia, is I came here and I realized that the best animation program in the country is here at BYU. It's the BYU Center for Animation, and it's a really interesting program. They win the Student Emmy every single year. They have a little Emmy competition for student projects, and they win the Student Emmy every year. If they don't win first place, it's because they had two groups, and one of the groups won first, and one of the groups won second. That's how dominant this group is. And the thing that's interesting about this group is how they embrace this idea of group creativity. Every other animation program does individual projects, where each student will develop their idea, their story, their script, they'll animate it, they'll mod it up, they'll do all that kind of stuff. At the Center for Animation, they don't do this. They do... they get this group of about 20 junior students that are juniors in the program, and they all pitch their ideas about what kind of a project they want to work on, and they vote on the project that they want to do. The faculty hardly don't tell them what to do at all. They just kind of give them advice and say, well, you may want to consider this. This is something you may want to think about. But they vote on the project that they want to do. They vote on who the student director is going to be, who the student producer is going to be, and then they self-organize themselves into various different teams. And I would see this happen. So, like, the student would come up to the instructor and say, you know what? I really want to learn how to animate hair. I've worked a little bit on fur and hair, and I really like it. I think it's kind of fun. I'd like to animate fur and hair. And the instructor would be like, well, that's really cool. You know what? Nobody wanted to do that last project. We had awful hair. Everything else was great, but we had awful hair at that project. We're going to have really awesome hair on this project because you're going to work on this. This is really great. So awesome. You're interested in that? Go for it. So they self-organize themselves into teams. You know, one team might be working on technical issues. One team might be working on graphics, and one team might be working on storyboards. So this core group work on this project as a group of about 20 people for the whole year, their senior year, and then submit it to the Emmy competition. Then they all graduate and go work for Pixar. But the interesting thing is then they also start to bring in new students, so students that aren't even in the program yet. Mm-hmm. These are like freshmen and sophomores that want to be in the animation program eventually, but they're not even in the program yet. And they come up and say, hey, can I work on the project? I want to get experience. And they say, sure. And they put them onto these teams where they then work alongside these more senior students.
Wow.
And it made it actually really hard to research them because I wanted to do social network analysis, but it was hard because they kept getting new people. Every week I would show up and there'd be new people there. And I'm like, what the heck? How do I research you guys if you keep changing every week? But there probably were, at the end, 40 people that had their hands on that project. Some of them were seniors from the year before that were just wanting to kick around for a little bit longer, get some extra experience. Some of them were freshmen and sophomores. I mean, there were people from all over working on that project. They had music majors, they had film studies majors, they had computer science majors, graphics majors, animation majors. They were all working on this project to make this film. And that, I think, is what makes them successful. And I think that's one of the secrets of this group creativity, is this getting people with diverse experiences together, empowering them so that they recognize the power of their perspective and feel free in using it and sharing it, and then basically managing all of that process so that it works well together.
So that's the, I guess, the million-dollar question to me then is, that's a great example. It's a very, in many ways, informal in that it's not a structure. It's not, like you said, the professor's not walking in the classroom and saying, you will be working on hair this semester, and then putting teams together based on some formula that he or she thinks would make a nice team and then sending them off. But like you said, people come and go. So what do you do in a traditional, if you're an instructor and you'd like to facilitate something that you've just described, what are some of the key facilitation strategies and kind of what would you suggest if someone said, okay, exactly, I want to do that in my class. How do I make that happen and create that environment with my students?
So are we talking typical
course
kind of class?
Well, let's say it's a higher ed. You've got a 16-week class, and the first night of class, you're describing to the students what you're going to be having them do and try to create this exactly the scenario you described with the project you mentioned.
So I guess I'll preface one of the things I'm going to say, because I think one of the challenges we have with teaching group creativity is that our school system is set up to not facilitate it very well. Mm-hmm. This idea that things have to happen by semester, they have to happen 3 credit hours every week, and
there's a start line and a finish line.
And there's a start line and a finish line, and no, you cannot participate because you're not registered, so sorry. Yeah. You know,
or you have to participate, you know.
Yeah,
I don't want to work on hair. I want to work on something tough. We're working on hair this semester. That's what should be working on.
You know, it's kind of funny. It's very much, Regaluth talks about this a lot, Charlie Regaluth, but we very much are in an innovation age, teaching in an industrial age system. So education is set up from, you know, in an industrial age kind of a system, and it doesn't facilitate what we're trying to do with group creativity. I've actually, I think we should do quite a few things to kind of reform the way we're doing our teaching. And I think one of those would be to kind of throw some of these time constraints and other constraints out the window and focus more on competencies, focus more on creativity, and allow those things to emerge as they emerge. But that's kind of a different kind of a thing. So how can we do this in an actual course as best as we can?
Right, kind of with the reality that we have.
With the reality of
yeah.
what we're dealing
with. Yeah.
Well, I think there are some things that we can do, and I think there are things that are very uncomfortable sometimes as instructors. I've dealt with this myself as being very uncomfortable with them. But we have to acknowledge that creativity emerges when people are very powerfully, intrinsically motivated about the thing that they care about. So instead of us telling them, you know, hey, somebody has to animate hair. You, animate the hair.
Yeah.
You know, that's not going to, but, you know, but allowing people within a domain and say, look, this is what we're working on. What piece can you take ownership on that you care passionately about and will want to engage yourself in a very deep level in? You know, we want to make this film. What can you do to make this film better? Oh, you can animate hair? That's awesome. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, but I think we can do the same kind of thing in other projects. We have this project, and maybe that's it's a big, you know, kind of a major project with, you know, groups of three or four. But then you tell each person and say, what can you do to make this project successful, something that you are interested in? I'll give you what was the example? Flew my mind.
Well, you're thinking about that. I just wanted to mention Peggy's saying, I used the example of a 16-week semester in higher ed, and she said, well, what about when you have a 15-minute block of, you have the students for 50 minutes, and, you know, and then they're off to the next subject. Okay, be creative now.
Oh, you're being creative? Stop it. Stop. Time to go to math, you know.
Exactly.
That's one of the problems I have with school as well is, you know, one of the main things that facilitates creativity is flow, which is a funny-sounding name.
I did want to talk to you about this because when I was reading it in your paper, I very much view that as an individual thing where you're sitting and you're so engrossed in your own thing you're working on, and I did not ever contemplate it in a group scenario. So, yeah, why don't you describe the concept in general and then how
it
applies.
Let's talk about that for just a minute. So flow, of course, came from Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, and I should get a PhD just for being able to pronounce that.
I don't even attempt it. I just say the guy that wrote that flow stuff.
Yeah, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. And so he developed this theory, and it's interesting. It's not a theory for him of creativity. It's a theory of happiness. People are happy when they're in flow. But then they started figuring out, well, not only are they happy, they're extremely productive when they're in flow. That is when the magic happens. The magic sauce is flow. That's when people are in this state where time kind of stands still. They lose track of time. They don't know what's happening. Oh, I missed dinner 2 hours ago. And they're just so engrossed in the work that they're doing. And their senses are heightened to a really large degree. It's where they observe things that they normally wouldn't observe, and they're seeing things that they normally wouldn't see. And that all comes to play into doing something very powerful on this project. Well, now think about that with the senses being really heightened and you know, all that kind of a thing. That can facilitate a group interaction at a very powerful level. And one of Csikszentmihalyi's students was Keith Sawyer. And he studied with Csikszentmihalyi. And then Keith Sawyer has written a book called Group Genius. And in there, he talks about group flow. And he gives these conditions for what group flow is. But Keith Sawyer had this perspective. He was a jazz musician. How does jazz happen? Jazz happens in groups. It does not happen individually. Mm-hmm. You can't do jazz individually. You have to do it as a group. And the group, and a very core part of jazz is that you improv. And as one person starts to improv, the rest of the group, because of their relationships with that person, they've worked with that person many times, they know what that person is doing. When that person starts to riff in a certain way, they know where he's going with it, and they can back him up with the other instruments. And then they know when he's going to cut out and when they need to take over. And he calls that deep listening, listening at a very deep level where you're very much in tune with your group members. Same thing happens in sports. You know, you look at a really high-quality basketball team where you know, a lot of times you watch the NBA and it's just boring. They're not doing anything. But then there'll be these moments of like 5-minute segments where the whole team is just in sync with each other. And they call it the eyes in the back of the head. How did you know he was behind you as you went to pass that ball? It's because you just work together enough and you're paying attention to each other and you just know things about each other. So that's kind of what I'm interested in is I believe, and Keith Sawyer believes this as well, that these kinds of things happen in other kinds of group settings as well, where you can be working with someone and be very much engrossed and in tune, not only with the project, but with each other. So where you know what each other's strengths and weaknesses are, you know how to rely on each other, you know where someone's going to go with this and where someone's going to do this and this and this. And that kind of a thing is very hard to capture, very hard. But when it does, that is when the big breakthrough innovations emerge. When you go back and kind of, it's almost easier to identify after the fact. And you go after the fact and say, wow, this was a really big invention. How did this invention happen? And you go back and actually talk about how that invention happened. It was a moment of group creativity and group flow. And you say, wow, you know, how do we capture that in a bottle? It's really difficult. So, but I think there are conditions that facilitate it and make it more likely to happen but you still got to get the right kind of people, the right kind of environment, and the right kind of project to make the magic happen.
So yeah, and as I mentioned, I've always thought of that like flow being something, especially in an educational setting when it's used, is trying to get the student and so engrossed in the material that they're not, you know, it's just as you're saying, self-directing and taking it to a different level than you ever could have imagined. And then I think from what I'm understanding from what you're saying is then wrap around that then the interactions that they have with others. Because you can't have really the one with a you can't have the group without the individual, right? You can't have one guy not paying attention, right? And not in the moment. Everybody individually has to be in the moment and then working in some type of collective manner on the group, whatever the group is working on, right?
And really, and that's what's so hard about it, is you have to get everyone caring about the project enough that they're all engaged and that they care about what they're working on. And the way you do that is by getting a project that everyone really does care about and that they want to be. So you look at this animation group. They all want to make this film. They love this film, even if it wasn't their film originally. It was someone else's idea that got picked. That's okay. But they love what they're doing, and they love making this film. And even though they're each doing different things, they love it. And they work together in the same lab, and they're sharing ideas back and forth, and they're working with each other. And are you going to do that? Okay, well, then I'll work on this. And the beauty of it is how they're able to create this synergistic vision of what it is they're trying to accomplish. And then that vision drives everything that they're doing, and then they have this intrinsic motivation, which I call a hacker ethic, because it's really manifests itself a lot in like hackers that, you know, they just so care about what they're doing that they're willing to just push on the weekends and in the evenings and things like that because they care about the project. And that's when things get really magical.
So how would you contrast the things that you have read about and the things you've researched to just what we've all read about project-based learning, where you create some type of either real or imagined scenario and off you go? Like, you know, how do you – is it more the self-directed nature of it and defining the terms of the project they're working on? Is that a component of it, or what other components are part of it as well?
So I think that, you know, problem-based learning and project-based learning and constructivism and social constructivism and, you know, this group creativity that I'm talking about, I think they're all shades of similar things but emphasizing different aspects of it. So I like problem-based learning quite a bit, and I'm more familiar with that than project-based learning. But I love problem-based learning. I think it's excellent. But one of the things that is challenging about it is still very much top-down a little bit. The teacher creates the problem that the students then have to solve, and the teacher is a little bit more hands-on facilitating than in the setting I'm kind of talking about. So I think you're right. The kind of thing I'm talking about, the instructors are still there for sure, but they're there more as consultants, and the students take on a level of autonomy and ownership for the project. They have to, because that is ownership and autonomy is so critical to creativity. And I can talk more about it. I can give you an example of that here in just a sec too. So the autonomy and the ownership is so important, and then that they have the ownership of that and of the idea, and also that they're emphasizing the creativity. So this isn't solving a problem necessarily, mm-hmm. as much as creating a new thing altogether. Like, what problem did the iPad solve? I didn't know I had a problem until the iPad came along. But, you know, that's what Apple does. And what a lot of innovative companies do is they don't just solve a problem. They actually just innovate and just create something new that changes our whole way of looking at things. And so I think it's similar to project-based learning and problem-based learning, but emphasizes more that autonomy, that entrepreneurship, and also emphasizes more that creativity outcome rather than – it's more of a divergent outcome rather than a convergent problem-solving outcome.
And it, like you're saying, yeah, for like a problem-based approach, there usually is an underlying problem that you're trying to tackle.
And with an answer, like, probably.
Exactly. And so I'm just kind of thinking like some of the of Jonathan's later works when he was like looking at how the process of problem-solving and doing the analysis, drilling down to figure out the possible cause of the problem, those types of things. And so, you know, it's a fairly regimented way of attacking problems. And so as you're saying, it's not starting with a problem and kind of working through a problem-solving process necessarily. But then it is similar in terms similar. Of what you're talking about with the as the process is moving forward with the students, is being that person offering a critique and offering feedback and knowing when to step in and when to let go, and how to actually kind of help frame this experience at the outset. As you're mentioning, if it is a course with a title in it, you should be learning the content relative to the title, that they're not running off with a project that has nothing to do with the subject of the class. So sort of kind of looking at it from that standpoint, the facilitation side and offering feedback and guidance and critique, can you describe the role of the instructor in that capacity?
Yes. So it's, you know, and even though I know you brought me on to talk about this study that I did out at the University of Georgia, which they did an excellent job as well, sometimes it's a little bit easier to use this Center for Animation example, because I think the instructors there take it to such an extreme. This level is so different from the way we teach anywhere else. But they're very, you can't argue with the success that they have, because their students get jobs. They all work at Pixar. Their mm-hmm. students win the student Emmy every year. Their students know animation better than anybody else. So, I mean, you can't argue with it. But you talk to them, and he says, my job is to facilitate learning opportunities for them and to manage relationships. He sees himself as a relationship manager. I'm talking about the director of the mm-hmm. Center for Animation here at BYU. He says, I manage the relationships. He works primarily with the project leads, so the students self-organize themselves into teams, and those team leads will interact a lot with Brent, the instructor, and he will interact with them primarily and manage relationships throughout, and then he'll create opportunities for them. So he will bring in outside experts and say, this week we're bringing in a hair expert from Pixar, and she's going to be here today, and she's going to talk to you, and she's going to actually work with you all day long today on your project. And then next week I'm going to bring in someone from Sony to work with you. And so he would bring in these outside people to share expertise and to actually work side by side with the students for a period of time, which was amazing. And then he would facilitate things on campus. So the Center for Animation is not a department on campus. It's actually made up of faculty from like three different departments, okay. which administratively is impossible. That's a nightmare to have something that's not owned by any college or any department on campus. So a lot of what he's doing is negotiating back and forth. Okay, computer science, we need you to provide us with this, and fine arts, we need you to provide us with this, and we need you to provide. And he's just kind of behind the scenes creating the support structure so that the students can do what they do. And then on an actual week-to-week basis, they meet twice a week in what they call dailies. They call it dailies because in the animation world they do it every day. Mm-hmm. But in their setting, they do it twice a week. So they would get together for their dailies in this big theater, and they would show their work up on the projector, and all the students would sit and give feedback to each other, and it's directed by the student director. So the instructor just sits in the back, and the student director brings it up and says, okay, let's all give feedback on this thing here, and what do we think? Is this what we're looking for? Do we need something a little different? And they sit and critique back and forth, and the instructor just sits back there, and every now and then we'll just pipe up and go, now, wait a minute. You know, one of the things you're not thinking about that I've had some experience with past groups about is this is going to happen down the road, and so you want to keep that in mind as you're thinking about this. So that was kind of his role on a week-to-week basis, was let them do their thing, but if they start to maybe take a risk that would be too risky, mm-hmm. or start to maybe go on a divergent kind of a path, you can.
Or they weren't aware of, you know, group
yeah, they just weren't
C
aware
tried this before, so here's what their outcome exactly. was. Check and see how that worked out for them or whatever.
Exactly. And he would even say that. He'd say, you know what, before you do that, you may want to check with the seniors mm-hmm. And ask, because they dealt with that a little bit in their project. And so why don't you go talk to so-and-so on the senior project? But, you know, I'm thinking you're not going to maybe want to go that route. And that was kind of what he saw as his role was. And he was very open about it. He says, I don't grade them. They grade themselves. They tell me what grade they want, and that's fine. And you know, he didn't see himself in a traditional teacher role. He saw himself in a, well, he saw himself as a teacher, but more as a consultant, mm-hmm. teacher consultant.
So what's exciting and yet at the same time depressing is, going back to our comments a moment ago, is it sounds almost impossible to contemplate as the K-12 teachers in the chat room are mentioning, in a 50-minute time block when you have the students, or even in a 16-week semester. You can't turn these things on and off and just, you know, have someone right there to be able to provide the feedback at the moment it's needed before they're on to the next class or whatever it might be. So any words of wisdom from that standpoint? Like, anything's like whether we can borrow? And
Well, and I do think when you're dealing with kids, I mean, you got to realize, you'd have to scale the level of scaffolding that you provide for the level of ability of the people to self-regulate themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So college students are quite different from third graders, you know, and wherever you're at along that spectrum. But I think you can do things where trying to work on projects that, like you talk about project-based learning, try to find projects that are open-ended, projects that are bigger than just one person can handle, so that they have to work as a group. Not because, oh, the teacher made us work in a group on this project, because I can't do this thing on my own. I have to work with you to make this happen. You know, so the project is big enough, it's open-ended enough, it's something that the students have some choice in and some ownership in. So,
but there is, it sounds like you're saying there is some degree that, especially in younger students with the role definition, right? That, and then as you're answering the question, I sound like this. But that's not the world we live in, because what about the whole concept then of the teacher's role in terms of assessment?
Wait a minute. That's not the world we live in?
I'm sorry.
When you go to Google...
that's the world we live in.
You work 20% of the time on open-ended, unfunded, anything projects where Google says, we want you in that 20% of the time to come up with something awesome. We have no idea what that awesome is, so go do it.
I misspoke. I didn't mean the world we live in. I mean the world we learn in. How's
that? The world we learn in, right.
The world we learn in. I should have clarified. It's not the typical world we learn in, Sorry, but go ahead. Yeah,
no, but you're absolutely right. And the funny thing is, everyone knows about Google's 20% rule. What they maybe don't know is that that I've been able to find, all majorly innovative companies do the same thing. Intuit, FL Gore, the ones that make the post-it notes.
3M
does it. They all do the same thing, where they have unstructured time for employees, where they expect them to work, but they can choose the project that they work on, they choose who they work with, and they choose, you know, how they're going to do it and all that kind of thing. And then they have to pitch it. And then they have to pitch it back to the company and see, you know, what the value is of the thing that they were doing. So I think in learning situations in schools, I think we can do things similar to that. We can say, look, students, we need to do something related to social studies, and we need to look at something in the 19th century. You know, these are various kinds of things we can look at. What kind of, out of these range of projects, because we need to scaffold them a little bit more, out of this range of projects, what are you interested in? What do you want to work on? And what will you do to show your learning in this project? Are you going to create a film? Are you going to create a paper? Are you going to create and let them have some ownership about how they're going to do the project. And then, you're going to have to keep them on task. Kids they're just not cognitively as developed as adults are. So they're going to have to be reminded. They're going to have to be helped and supported. But, you know, emphasizing their ownership in the project, something that they care about quite a lot, and that it's open-ended, that you are not telling them what has to happen, but that by doing something, they will learn content. They'll have to learn about things. I'll give you an example here. So are you familiar with the Odyssey of the Mind program?
Mm-mm.
So both my daughters just barely did this program. It was developed by a creativity researcher. I can't remember the name, but the idea, it's an after-school program right now where the kids get together. You talk about 50-minute segments. That's all they have, 50-minute segments once a week. And they get into teams of 4 to 5 students. These are elementary kids mostly. Actually, I think it goes up to high school too, but my daughters did it as elementary. So they're with elementary kids. They have a coach, and the coach is told, you are not allowed to give them ideas. All you do is manage relationships, keep them on task, you know, maybe ask a question, but not a leading question like, well, maybe you should do this. No, but just seriously a question like, what do you guys want to do about this? That's all you do as a coach, and provide a place for them to do it and provide the resources for them, a lot like this Center for Animation person. Mm-hmm. So, for example, my daughters, the context was architecture, and they were supposed to develop a musical about architecture. And there were things that they had to do related to that. So they ended up deciding to do a project about the Leaning Tower of Pisa and about various different art forms that were going to be stored within the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And there was a plot, there was a robbery, there was, you know, all this exciting stuff going on. And they composed music, they did choreography, they actually did sculpting. They sculpted out various different pieces of art. They learned about 19th century architecture because that was what they were dealing with. They learned a great deal about the architecture of this time period. I don't even know anything about it, so I can't tell you about it, but my daughter can tell you all about it. Mm-hmm. And it was this really exciting project for them. They got to pick the project. They got to develop how to do it. And when they wanted to learn more about architecture, then the coach said, well, let me go bring in a professional architect to talk to you. So she brings in a professional architect to help them. Oh, you want to do some sculpting? Well, let me bring in a professional sculptor to help you with this. And I think that's something that we can do. This was 50-minute segments every week. I know it's hard to do in the school systems that we have, but if we can carve out opportunities for kids to work on projects and say, I'm going to facilitate you getting instruction from really cool people that can help you, and you're going to be able to be successful in this project that you care about that's going to be then put on a public display, I think kids can get really excited about that.
Yeah, I don't know if you can see, Peggy George is mentioning in the chat room, she was also took part in this when she was a teacher, and she said at the time she worked on it was called Olympics of the Mind, and she said it's now called the Odyssey of the Mind. And as she mentioned, it was also not part of the school day, so it's almost considered, an extracurricular, be creative on your own time.
Right. We don't care about that. Pass the test.
Yes, exactly.
I do care about, I really am actually very standards oriented, even assessment oriented. I think it's good to have goals to shoot for and to measure our progress towards those goals. I just think creativity should be incorporated as one of those goals that we are trying to strive towards.
Well, and I think some of the walkaway points of what you're saying is some things even though we have certain things, a world we live in where the educational system looks like it does for now anyway, we have certain constraints. There's still things you can do, right? There's still ways you can structure the time you do have and put more autonomy and into the kids' hands in terms of what they're working on and be there to facilitate and help with what it is they are driving. They're kind of driving the boat in some regards. It's kind of, and I wrote in the chat room when you were speaking that this unstructured time can be kind of a scary thing for us that are control freaks. And I've got this objective. I need you to learn this, and so I will tell you what you need to know, and then you can repeat it back to me. It's
very scary, very scary. And my daughter was actually on one of the teams that took first in the state. But it was interesting. We laughed when they found out they won because I've been to several of their practices. It was a mess. It was an absolute mess. Like, we got to the point where, as parents, we almost bagged the whole thing and said, you know what, this is dumb. Let's just not do this. This is just not working. The kids are just, like, not doing anything, you know. They're so unstructured, and they're so – but out of that chaos emerged something really great that they were able to do really well in their competition. So I think we got to be careful that sometimes, you need to – and this is where the – so we talk about what's the role of the teacher. The role of the teacher becomes someone who can – understand when to rein back that chaos and when to allow it to kind of just go for a little bit longer and let's see what happens. And that's going to become a skill, I think, in the 21st century.
Now, so far, everyone we've talked about, well, although you just said your kids were not necessarily always, it didn't seem like they're always on point, but that is a good point. A lot of things we're talking about are giving them the autonomy, so presumably they'll want to finish and work toward it. But what about those stragglers that just either quit, don't want to do it? Any words of wisdom, pearls of wisdom that you've come across in terms of bringing folks back into the fold?
That's really hard. And I fully recognize this is hard stuff to make happen, right? Creativity is hard to facilitate. And it will, will be able to exhibit it to varying levels of success. I think we can teach it, but realizing that some people will progress faster in that than others, just like in any subject. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it'll be hard. There will be some stragglers. I think by engaging them in projects that are intrinsically motivating to them, they'll want to continue on that. And when it's not intrinsically motivating to them, then it becomes harder to push them. Say, well, be creative on this thing. And they're like, I don't care about that thing.
Right.
But if you get some, and I'll give you, here's an example. So this is in elementary, and maybe not a perfect example. It wasn't group oriented, it was individual oriented. But let's just use it as an example. Is my daughter had a teacher who, in this certain grade level, I think it was third grade, they needed to do an Indian report on Native Americans. And so she and my oldest daughter got to choose the tribe to study. And she picked a tribe that she cared about personally because her favorite cousin is a member of this tribe. Mm-hmm. So she was very excited about this tribe. And she did the most amazing thing. And the requirement was she had to write a paper, she had to do a presentation, she had to do a creative artifact, so she like made moccasins. But her paper was amazing, if I thought. I thought it was awesome. She learned so much about Indians. She spent all summer reading books about Native Americans because she wanted to just soak up anything she could find on Navajos. Mm-hmm. Well, my other daughter comes along, and it's she doesn't care as much about doing this in the first place. And then she's not really allowed to pick the tribe. She said, well, why don't you do the Sioux tribe? Okay. Nobody else is doing Sioux. Somebody has to do Sioux, so why don't you do the Sioux tribe?
Okay.
And she didn't want to do the Sioux tribe, and it was a lot harder for her. And we eventually found a way to get her kind of excited about a part of it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it just wasn't there for her. And I think sometimes we worry so much about covering the breadth of material. Mm-hmm. I think if we were to allow people to follow their passion, we would achieve such depth in their learning that it would more than make up for the fact that maybe we didn't achieve the breadth.
You know, you're hitting it. I always talk about you have to kind of balance the messy and the magical when you're, I think, as an instructor, that's kind of your job, is like the messier things, you know, like you're saying, it can't go out of control, but it seems like in the messiness is when the magic happens. And so being able to, you know, kind of to allow it to happen is I think that's the key, is like knowing when to step in. And actually, before we end, I've had several questions in the chat room, and I don't want to miss the one about the online learning. Like, how does this all translate to an online learning environment?
So that is the big question. And that's actually the research that I am pushing on in the near future. That's going to be the research I'm going to do. Here's the problem. Keith Sawyer, you remember I mentioned him before. Mm-hmm. He's kind of the leading expert on group creativity. He will tell you it can't happen online. He'll just tell you that. Mm-hmm. Because the friction, he calls it, you know, well, actually Jonah Lear calls it this, you know, the friction between other people, the bumping into people, the kinds of information that's communicated face-to-face that you can't quite communicate as well online. The deep listening that we talked about, that's really hard, where you're just really hyper-aware of your group members, he says that just doesn't happen online. And so he applauds people like Marissa Meyer from Yahoo, who outlawed telecommuting. And he says she's right, because it can't happen online. And if they want to be an innovative company, they're going to have a setting. And there's some interesting truth to that. You look at Google. Everyone talks about how awesome the Googleplex is. They give you free. They got this buffet with all this yummy food you can eat. They've got free workout facilities. They got free this. Why do they have all that stuff? It's because they want to keep you on campus. They don't want you going home. So they want you to stay on campus after hours and all this kind of stuff.
But so, wouldn't then using the tech, wouldn't open source software then be kind of the, yeah, but what? What about
yeah,
this?
But what? Exactly. You know? And that's kind of where I'm trying to look at this, is yeah, but what? And I really am looking at this objectively. I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe we can't facilitate group creativity online as easily as we can in person. I think it can happen, but maybe it can't happen as well online as it can in person. But maybe it can. And what you talked about with open source software, I think, is maybe one of the clues that we have that maybe this can happen. And so that's the research I want to do in the future, is trying to look at and say, we're going to have to get beyond asynchronous discussion boards, because that's not going to cut it. We need, I think, to look at what kinds of online interactions can facilitate the kind of group creativity that we're talking about. I think it can happen. Can it happen as well or as easily? I don't know. But I think we have to solve this problem, because online learning is not going away. So I believe group creativity is critically important for the 21st century. I believe a lot of 21st century learning is going to happen online. So we've got to solve this puzzle. And that's one of the things I want to look at. And that's going to be a challenging puzzle to solve.
Have you looked into any of the computer-supported collaborative work literature?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wrote a chapter last summer on that, and then how we could apply some of the things, the concepts and awareness and those types of things that, that are crucial when you're working with someone, and being able to have like breadcrumbs for your work product as it moves through the process, and where are we, and who worked on what, those types of things. And I'm a firm believer it can happen.
I think it can happen. I think you're talking about the project-based learning, the problem-based learning, all these different kinds of things. I think the collaborative problem-solving can happen easier online than this emergent improvisation group creativity stuff, I think is a lot harder. I agree with you that I think it can happen, but I think it is a lot harder to get this emergent, you know, group flow experience to happen online. But I think it can happen. I think we need to be able to solve that puzzle.
And that, you know, I know we're running long now, but I know you're touching on a lot of things. I think it also backs full circle to the beginning, talking about, are we talking, even as the group, are they working on a common deliverable? Or is it, are there just touch points when the group members come together? Like, maybe I'm working on my own individual project, but I'm coming together with the group for them to critique, give me a critique, or for them to give me feedback, or for them to, as you're saying, have a guest speaker or something like that, versus is the group in as a whole working on a common deliverable? And I think for the most part, what you're talking about is a common outcome, right? That the group's working on a common thing.
Right. That's what I'm talking about. It is, you can facilitate really high quality group interaction around an individual project. You know, let me give you feedback, let me give you critique. I think that kind of thing can happen really well online. Mm-hmm. This emergent group creativity is a lot more challenging, but I mean, it happens. I think we need better tools that facilitate the level of deep listening that we need to a higher level. And I think like these breadcrumbs, these analytics that leave traces behind that people can pick up on, and I think it's something that we're going to have to get better at as a society, mm-hmm. is facilitating that kind of thing, and as learners as well, because frankly a lot of online learning is so focused on information,
on content. Concepts.
Yes, mm-hmm. like the whole MOOC thing, which I like MOOCs, but I like them for what they do. What they do really well is teach information and concepts. And I worry that in the rush to be more efficient in our online learning, we will forget creativity, which is really important. And I think that can be facilitated, but it'll not be in the most efficient way.
Yeah. And really, this whole webcast series is really a response to MOOCs, because I've spent my master's and PhD program working on online learning and distance education, and this is not what I envision. As you're saying, MOOCs are great for content delivery to me. It's almost a next form of e-books, whatever, you know, having a video and a professor and some quizzes, whatever.
And much more powerful than a book, so I think they're great.
Exactly.
Much more powerful than a book. But
it doesn't incorporate all the things we've been talking about today, and that's why I really thank you very much for sharing. And we didn't get specifically, we touched upon your paper a little bit, but I did want to direct folks, if you head back over to edtechtalk.com/live/D4L, I know that's a long URL, we have the Titan Pad that gives a point to your papers. And is there a better place than others to try to find your bibliography of papers you've written and things you're working on right now?
You bet. And so, I think you shared these links before, but I have all my research up on Mendeley, as well as academia.edu, .edu is another place. And then you can go to my website, and my website links out to all of these places. And I have recordings of some of the presentations I've given on my website as well. So my website is richardewest.com. And I also tweet at Richard E. West, and I tweet about stuff related to creativity and innovation. I also have interests in just technology integration in general. So when you go to like Mendeley or to my Twitter feed, you'll see me talking about technology in education as well as creativity and this kind of stuff. So it's going to be all mixed in, but I will be talking about my stuff related to group creativity there. And Mendeley, you can go and download PDFs of all the articles. So Mendeley.com/, I think it's Richard E. West 1, I think, or something like that.
Perfect. And actually, probably, as far as an easy URL to remember, the RichardEWest.com is probably the easiest.
Probably the easiest.
Easiest to remember. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And any parting words, or did you run out of steam?
I could talk about this all day.
I know.
You know, I'd love the interaction, the feedback. If you have ideas, I'm a big believer in group creativity as well, so share with me your ideas. And I think this is a situation that is a 21st century skill when we talk about this. This is hard work. Trying to teach and facilitate the development of group creativity in students is hard work, but I think this is the essential skill that they need for the 21st century. This is what companies want. This is what will produce the answers to the challenges we have in our society. We can't leave this behind.
I agree. Yay. Well, come back anytime. And like I said, I'm sorry we didn't get to fully cover your paper, but it was certainly the point of introduction for us to have this conversation. So thank
Sounds
you very
great.
Much.
Well, thank you for letting me on.
Us.
See ya.
We'll see you later. Bye-bye. Thank you.